Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue our appeals to heaven. And even though emotions and I think everybody's kind of going sideways because they're being driven by emotions, we as a people need to unite on the Constitution. And so with that, let me just kind of throw it out there that as we go through the Constitution, because that's what we're going through, folks. We're going through this thing line by line. And so hopefully we're covering things and exposing you to the framers' paradigm. Well, that's what we're doing. And hopefully that helps you to start connecting dots so that we can see how important it is that all of those in service supposedly are public servants, regardless if they're elected, appointed, or just an employee, that they all support the Constitution. We have to hold them accountable. That's what we have to do. And so, anyway, welcome back, Sean. And I think we left off Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 4, I think. Or we're going into, 4, right? Because we haven't done the coin value thereof and so forth. So, before we get started, anything?
Not really, sir.
Okay, all right, that's fine. No questions from last week or what have you, okay. Or from the previous readings, I'm all good, okay. So, let's go ahead and start with subsection 4 and look at what the federal government is being delegated here. So, go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures.
Okay, and actually, now it dawned on me, we did cover this because I was going to look into, and actually you already did, you looked into it before we cut out, that this was actually formally done in the 1980s, 70s? It wasn't,
correct.
It wasn't that long
ago. We tried to go to the metric system.
Correct, yeah, correct. And, okay, so because we didn't dive into this a little bit more, do you see anywhere here where it tells them that they have the power to create a bank and actually generate revenue via a bank?
Absolutely not.
As a matter of fact, when we look at the way the government is to generate revenue, it is right up above where it basically says that they shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. That's it. They don't have the ability to start manufacturing money and money products, i.e. bonds. Did you hear what I just said? Bonds. Not for just you, but everybody out there. That is exactly what Alexander Hamilton did with the first charter. And as a matter of fact, if you read through the regulations that they actually executed in the Bank Act, you know, it laid out how this money was going to get out there and that there would be people that would be out selling bonds where, and they would be paying interest on people investing into the American bank. So, that was well outside. That is not within the scope of coining money and regulating the value thereof. Don't know how they, you know, well, so I just think Hamilton was a slick talker. And as a matter of fact, there's no doubt in my mind, he offered those members of Congress a way of getting rich because it's the same thing that happens today. They have insider trading. They get, you know, the first drink at the well so that they can make the most money. And so anyway, Let's dive into subsection 5.
The Congress shall have power to provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States.
Okay. So that means, what is, does this give them the power for creating a bank?
No.
What is this? This is different. They're actually defining a crime that Congress shall have the power over. This is one crime that they can charge people with. They have the authority in the Constitution to engage, enforce, and charge people and define the punishments thereof. That's what it says. To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. So it's basically counterfeiting. It's a criminal power to be able to create a crime and punish American citizens. That's it, though. Does this mean that they can create a crime for kidnapping? Crossing state lines kidnapping? No. In other words, when we look at what's being delegated in the Constitution, these are the things they have the authority to do. When it comes to crime, obviously the Constitution identifies the crimes that the federal government has the authority to execute, punish, and define the punishments thereof, and so forth. And there's only a couple. Treason is one we already kind of covered. We talked a little bit about it. And now the securities. So, let's go to the next one.
To establish post offices and post roads.
Okay, so this is a power granted to Congress to establish post offices and post roads. Does that mean that they will build them?
No, just establish them.
Right, so in other words, they'll identify the routes of the Postal Service. They'll identify the places for the postal offices. Now, I want everybody to understand this. This is actually in the Constitution. And most people have a problem with the post office. You know, if we didn't have, I mean, everybody hates the lack of efficiency. Everybody hates the cost constantly going up. Now, it doesn't say that they are to provide free postal service. So they kind of went down this path of trying to create a no-cost postal service. Okay. Well, they ended up taking on more and more. And so because they're operating the delivery thereof, right? Does it say that they're going to operate the delivery thereof and the processing and all of that?
Well, I mean, if established doesn't mean build the roads, then I guess established would mean they don't build the post offices either. They just establish.
Right. And as a matter of fact, when you get into James Monroe's veto of the bonus, not the bonus bill, I think it was the Cumberland Gap Bill, where Congress was trying to give themselves the authority and power to start taxing the states to make improvements for critical highways and waterways. And in that bill, they justified it by basically saying, well, we have the power to establish post roads, and therefore we need to be able to build those. And James Monroe said, and there were six others, right? There were a total of six. And James Monroe came back and said, hold on here. Even if you took all of those, and actually it's worth pulling up, so I'm going to look for the placement where that is. And let me find James Monroe. There it is. There's the Monroe there, but I'm looking for Monroe's veto statement. And I think it's actually, might even be, help me out. I think it might be a PDF file, but it's worth pulling up because they list these six things that they're supposed to be able to do. And James Monroe basically says, even if you tied all of those together, that
is not what you're mentioning is not within those powers, not even included. So I'm not seeing it in here, and I know I've got it. So what I'll do is I'll come back to it after the break. I'll take the time to find it. And this is important because we look today at the federal government basically saying it's a no-brainer. We have the authority to control the roads, post offices, everything under the sun. And so that goes down to that cod fishery bounty where they started using the ability to tax and spend money. That shoot, if it comes to money, then they can control everything. And that's not what this Constitution is delegating. Anyway, okay, so the next one is kind of interesting, and this is worth diving into in today's paradigm. But let's go ahead and go to the next one. Congress shall have the power to promote
the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings. And
then there's, so they go to the next one, but that's okay. Every once in a while, that's in there. Actually, that should be a semicolon. There's a semicolon. So with the semicolon, they don't need the and there. But anyway, okay, so what this is doing is it's stating that they want to promote the progress of science and arts or inventions. So for a limited time, they will secure to the authors and inventors exclusive rights to their respective work. And so what this means is that for a limited time, you will be able to, create something, write something, and nobody can copy it. And the initial limitation of time was 7 years. Today, authors, inventors, and so forth, I think there are some caveats. I believe pharmaceutical companies have 20, 25 years, something like that. From the inception of development, research, testing, and manufacturing, selling, deployment, and so forth. Now, when we look today at how many people are getting very rich because the federal government has provided perpetual copyrights. And as a matter of fact, not only have they provided perpetual copyrights, but this office has become so corrupt that if there is a copyright that comes in, that is something that would be a huge interest of the government to control, then they basically make sure that that copyright gets into the hands of somebody else that can actually deploy that faster. And I'll give you a good case in point, because I've actually had him, Michael McKibbins has been on this show, and Michael McKibbins actually invented Facebook. He provided the patent office with the code, source code, and everything else. And next thing you know, Zuckerberger deploys Facebook. He didn't call it Facebook, but what Zuckerberg deployed was exactly what he did. And there's an active lawsuit. He's going after them. And bottom line, it's just stonewalling. They're just stonewalling him in being able to, prove that Facebook and everything that Zuckerberger had made and has been doing has been off of his technology. Now, one of the things I learned, you probably played with copyrights before, right?
I've looked them up before.
Okay.
To chase down different issues.
Okay, so have you ever played with authoring things to where you wanted to make sure you had a copyright for it? Because there's a poor man's way of copywriting something. And in the old days, a poor man's way of copywriting, because, they charge a lot of money to do this. Before, this was their job. In other words, managing the copyrights is something that they have to pay for. In other words, that's what we pay taxes for, is for them to do these very specific things. So when you have to actually pay to file and you got to pay to maintain, You're paying them to do this job. Where are they spending the tax dollars? It's not on doing those things they have the authority to do. They think that they have the ability to spend on general things, things that they want to spend. And this is a huge problem that people need to really start holding them accountable. But anyway, in this particular case, regarding the patents and so forth, when you look at like the Facebook, what Zuckerberg did, and you look at how they've benefited, or I should say, the deep state has benefited in controlling and manipulating the narrative. What happened in the late 1800s is the government actually started creating what's a good word for it? A nurturing environment for corporations to actually develop and grow. Because as the federal government started regulating corporations, they actually took away the teeth that the states had over corporations. In other words, if Walmart wanted to do business in particular states, and states already had businesses that were favorable to them, then they wouldn't have to basically, you know, give Walmart any, you know, any credence or even any access. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So it's one thing for you to make something and send it off. But if you're providing services within a state, that's your business, like Walmart. Walmart doesn't make anything. Now, Costco does make things, right? But what Costco does is they steal from other people, just like Amazon. They take the technology, they steal it, and then they basically claim it for themselves and start reselling or what have you. And so... when you look at Walmart, Walmart was just services. They weren't making anything. And so a state could literally say, well, if you're going to do services, you're going to have a store, then you need to do this, you need to do this. And each state was different. The same thing with timber, the same thing with all types of, I'll just say, market spaces. The states managed their market spaces the way they wanted to. Well, as these corporations, DuPont, Procter & Gamble in the mid-1800s, because Procter & Gamble, if I remember correctly, they kind of started about 1830, something like that, maybe even before that. And DuPont, same thing. And so these companies, as they started operating in just a few states, they started going to other states because there were minerals and so forth in there. And some of the problems that they were having was getting access to the minerals. And they needed the federal government to basically say, we're going to assume full control over that. And that's exactly what they did, so that they could basically make sure that the corporations, as long as they were paying the federal government, then the corporations could have access. In other words, the federal government started assuming control over everything so that they could manipulate, manage, and make money. And as not just make money, but create these long-term alliances with corporations, banks, and so forth. So this was the beginning of the federal government, or our government, becoming a corporate-focused entity, so that it literally started creating national corporate regulations. And that's when they started the antitrust acts at the end of the 1800s and so forth. So, but you don't see any, we've not read anything here that's given them the authority to do that, right? I think we already covered the Commerce Clause, and the Commerce Clause says to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the states, not within the states. And so this is how they backdoored the states, and this is how many of the states, I should say, the mature states, were very thankful because their corporations that were housed or homed in their states were making more money for them. And so the new states, they were able to basically take advantage of. They'd go in and start the mining without having to bring the rest of the business into state. And so there was less jobs and less opportunity for the people of that state. And so as we see what ends up happening when you create these types of alliances, there's nothing good about it. And as a matter of fact, it becomes this old term of payola. Got to pay to play. So anyway, as we kind of, I just want to kind of wrap up on this. When we look at how the federal government actually started exploiting their ability to control, this became huge. Now, today we have all sorts of opulent. I give Eric Clapton, because he's a real advocate, he's out there demanding perpetual copyrights. Well, that's fine throughout the world, but our federal government does not have the authority to provide perpetual copyrights. And as you look at what I just said, that means anybody could actually start ban. You can create a band, and you could actually start doing everybody's music, as long as it's older than a certain point of time. Well, can you imagine how much money they make? As a matter of fact, I saw a video that talked about how much money would be made if somebody monetized a video viral and it got 8 billion hits, and they talked about how many millions of dollars that would make. However, that's paying a lot of different people involved in that. In the new paradigm, if an individual can do everything, and they would make all that money instead of sharing it with the writers, the performers. I mean, everybody's got their little shares in this. This is one of the reasons why you see, and actually it kind of started in the 1970s, and there were groups, and I would say performers, that did everything. Have you ever, heard of Todd Rundgren's one? Alan Parsons Project. That was another one where a guy did everything in the studio himself. And so that means that the more you do, the more money you make. Now, there are some that talk about, and I'm down a rat hole here, but there are some that talk about the artistic license. I know that, I think Phil Collins was one that did a album where he played all the instruments, like Todd Rundgren and others. And he did that because he had the idea artistically of how he wanted it to be done. Now, that probably plays in the same with Todd Rundgren and others, but nevertheless, the point is that in those days, it probably was a financial benefit not playing other artists. I also heard in the same vein that Dave Gilmour, when he was doing one of his albums, he paid a guitarist $1,000 an hour to play on his solo album. And it was just like really costly for him to do that, but he really wanted that artist. So the point is that when we look at what should be happening today, it should only be 7 years. And as a matter of fact, the only reason why, and I can understand certain patents because the technology is that important that maybe we make it, a little bit more. But I still have a problem with that because I think the world or we as a nation benefit if we ensure that patents aren't perpetual or extended to a point where, it becomes a disadvantage because everybody is paying top dollar for something like pharmaceutical products, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. All right. So forgive me for going down that rat hole, but this is a big one that I have a real problem with, how they've basically moved us into perpetuity regarding these patents and so forth. Now, we're going into a break, and so because of that, we will have to pick up the next one, the Constitute Tribunals, Inferior, and the Supreme Courts and so forth. In other words, they have the power over the courts. It's right here. Anyway, so when we come back, we'll start off with that and talk about this power, and then we'll wait till Article 3 to dive into the other details of that. But we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're covering, sorry for the phone, it was just right there, I should have saw that, but anyway, now we're diving into the power over the court, and so it's really short, go ahead and cover this one, and we'll dive into this.
I had the power to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court.
Okay, so this means they have the power to form these tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. This is the entire federal court system. They have the power to create a federal court system. And so when you look at what they did, it became kind of a leviathan. And especially with John Adams, because John Adams had his midnight appointments, where he really extended the court. And Thomas Jefferson, when he became president, he goes, we don't need that many judges. Not at the federal court system. They don't have jurisdiction over hardly anything. So we'll get into the jurisdiction as well. But the fact is, the federal court system is created and controlled by the Constitution, or I should say Congress. And right here, in the ability to create inferior tribunals, I believe that this was a paradigm that they needed because of the, I'll just say, the way the distribution of government was going to be, and the burden of moving distances. In other words, without being connected, where you could do virtual governing, real-time governing, you actually had to put things out there so that it could exist. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so
they didn't have Zoom back then.
Yeah, they sure did. And so they needed to have a judge way out there. And so in some ways, it was either a curse to be appointed, and I honestly think it wasn't necessarily a curse. Let's just say this. When you look at the best lawyers and judges, what have you, do you think that they take the military route? Do you think they take the, you know, I got a guaranteed job this way, right?
I doubt that.
Right, seriously. Okay. So in other words, the people that would end up going out into the territories, these judges for that new state, for the region and so forth, do you think it was America's best and brightest? There you have it. The fact is that they probably had to, you know, sweeten the pot to get people to take on these sacrifices. You're going to go live out with the heathens, right? I mean, okay, so there was a huge disparity between rural American back then and the city and the towns in the developed states. In other words, they had theater. And I'm not talking about movie theaters. They didn't have that. But they had plays, theater, and so forth, where it could be supported, like Philadelphia, New York. In other parts of the states, like if you looked at the Carolinas, they were not developed well enough to be able to offer that much in the opulent form of society. Now, it is a natural desire for people to have, you know, if you've got the money, if you feel you have the power, the position, then it becomes natural for you to want to have better things. We've talked about this and why DC was basically developed at America's expense in providing for the opulent lifestyle of those people who got their shot in going in there. The lawyers and the judges and those people that had, you know, the prominence, they were, that's where they were. These folks going out into these inferior courts and into these territories and so forth, again, that wasn't the best and brightest. And actually, if you really think about, you know, who would you really select? Let me ask you this. If you've been in the Army, right, and you've been in other situations, even as a kid, you've picked teams, right? You ever remember picking teams like, you know, forming a baseball team or basketball team out of the neighborhood?
Absolutely.
And so you would pick, you know, those people that you liked, you got along with, that could perform, so forth and so on. There were different reasons why you would pick those guys, because they were a good player for these. And then the last guys picked, well, you know, you needed more players to, you know, to complete the team, and they would be in the, you know, like right field or left field or what have you, right? So, so it's the same thing back then when it came to judges and so forth. And it's kind of the same thing today. You know, those who are the best and brightest, they have aspirations. They, you know, I'm looking to get onto the Supreme Court. So they stay in these big states where there's lots of money, lots of lawsuits, where they can kind of churn and work their way into. Because, you know, the common thing that I've heard before is, oh, this judge has a brilliant mind for law. I don't know what that means. But it is something that we, you know, we kind of neglect. When they started creating these tribunals and these inferior courts, there were courts that were out of the overwatch and overseeing of, because they were just far away. When they started setting up these courts going to the, you know, to the rural states, to the western expanse, there was very little communication. I mean, I don't know what and how, but there's no doubt in my mind. Have you ever heard the saying about being the farther away from the flagpole?
No, I don't think I've heard that.
So the farther away from the flagpole, it's kind of like when the mice, when the cat's away, the mice will play. The further away from the flagpole, the more latitude you get. Whether that be in the battlefield or in garrison, the more latitude you get. Because if the superior ranks, who, you know, the guys that are in real control, you know, they're in D.C. and they're close to D.C. They want to be there because they want to control everything, and that's where you have to be. And so the further away you get to, like, you know, Okinawa or, you know, over to, you know, there's some, you know, really nice spots in Europe and Asia and so forth, but the point is, the further away you get from the flagpole, the more latitude you get. And I believe that, you know, this is just the nature of government. It's the nature of men. It's just the nature of way things work. So there's no doubt in my mind, we started seeing, and I actually can start citing some cases, like the Santa Clara case, where that's what the case where the federal government basically went sideways and said, you know what, we see this thing called a corporate person and granted or basically established personhood. This was like in the 1860s, 1870s. No, it was 1886, my bad. The point is that when we look at, you know, where these ideas come from, you know, they usually come from the far reaches. Plessy v. Ferguson. This was a southern case that, you know, was established, and that's where they started pushing the latitude. And then when it came up to the Supreme Court, everybody says, oh, well, they're going to shoot that down. But Taney, being a racist, absolutely, Taney supported the concept of separate but equal and established that as a doctrine. they use, actually, if you look at the further courts out, predominantly over history, they have been the petri dishes where they could push the boundaries of the Constitution. It doesn't happen in the D.C. area. It happens so that things slowly start changing. Now, the Scopes trial, if you look at the Scopes trial, that was in where? Do you know where that was?
I'm not sure.
Okay. The Scopes trial in 1920-something was in Pennsylvania. And this is where a teacher basically, I think the case was that he wasn't going to teach creation. He was going to teach evolution. And this is when the Supreme Court pulled it in. And this was one of those cases that was literally prepared for this agenda where Hugo Black, basically came down with the rule of uniforming all the law, that education would no longer promote creation, that they would only teach evolution. That was the Scopes trial. So we can see how they literally started creating a system that they could exploit unconstitutional law, exert unconstitutional powers, and literally hijack our entire system in creating this judiciary form of government. And it kind of all started right here with this ability to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court. Now, let me ask you this, because I understand that they couldn't do the, you know, real time, and they didn't see the dangers, but the 11th Amendment was passed when, do you know?
No, sir.
Okay, so the 11th Amendment, which is the amendment that actually changed the jurisdiction of the court. This is all important because it's all really connected. And so every time we talk about the court, I don't want to say rat holing, but I definitely want to go through how this is all connected. The 11th Amendment, okay, there were 12 amendments to the Bill of Rights. I think you've heard that before, right?
Correct.
And two of them have not been officially ratified at the time of the Bill of Rights. One was officially ratified that we know of because we saw it in our lifetime in 1992, which was the Second Amendment, or the second out of the 12. See, the first two were not ratified, supposedly. The second one was ratified in 1992. Technically, the first one actually was ratified. It's the Apportionment Amendment. It was ratified, and Connecticut just failed to file the paperwork properly. In other words, when they ratified it, they basically, because they were ratifying the amendments all separately. It was kind of like an a la carte thing. And so they looked at the amendment, they debated it, because they didn't debate all of them. They debated each and ratified each amendment one at a time. Connecticut ratified the very First Amendment, and they failed to actually file it properly, and it just went into a folder, into a drawer, into an office that it wasn't discovered until, if I remember correctly, it was in the last few decades where they kind of discovered that, and they go, that wouldn't be good if all of a sudden we, told everybody that we ratified that and that amendment is valid. So it was kind of suppressed because that amendment would have changed apportionment to where, because it clearly identified, and the reason Madison put that one amendment in is it clearly identified that to change the apportionment of one representative to represent more than 30,000 or less than 30,000 required an amendment. Therefore, when we look at that very First Amendment, if it got ratified, then the genie's out of the bottle. Everybody now knows that, you actually have to pass an amendment to change that number. Well, anybody that looks at the Constitution understands, especially if you look at the color-coded enumerations of the Constitution, we lay out what parts of the Constitution Congress has the ability to change. To just go in and we're going to change that one number. We're going to change this standard. We're going to change, you know, our pay, our benefits. They can't. Those are parts of the Constitution that you can't. The only place where they could actually change and, or I should say, make law and determine is what we're reading right now. They can't use an act to change the apportionment like they did in 1929 with the Reapportionment Act. And the evidence is right there in that very First Amendment of the Bill of Rights. Madison stated that's got to change, and the only way it can change properly is through an amendment. Anyway, so back to the courts and so forth. I believe that we're at a point that in a representative government, have I ever told you or mentioned to you how I believe that the Supreme Court and the district courts should be completely restructured into a single court? Have you ever heard that?
I don't believe I have.
Okay, so as a representative government, right, we're Republican in form. In other words, we have a, you know, initially we have the Articles of Confederation where our representatives manage both the judiciary, the executive and legislative functions. That was all done by Continental Congress. Well, they broke that up, but they tried to maintain this representation as much as possible. Well, they made a huge mistake with the court. Now, the president, he is selected by our electors, which is representative of the people throughout the different states. In other words, the people choose their electors, who then chooses the president and chooses the vice president separately. That's the Electoral College. In Congress, the Congress is obviously representative of the people in the House and the state legislatures in the Senate. Well, when we get to the court, the court's not representative of anything other than today. If you said, well, it seems that the court system is representative of the Ivy Tower school system. In other words, if you look at the Supreme Court, the judges that are appointed come from very specific schools, and they all come from the same paradigm. They're all taught from the same paradigm. They may have different paradigms that we would think. We think they're kind of divided. And in some ways, maybe there are some outliers, but I am very surprised that even Trump's appointments have made decisions that went contrary to what everybody thought. Right?
Definitely.
Okay. So I believe that the best thing we can do is make the courts representative. Don't allow a single body and don't allow the Senate to dictate who is going to become a Supreme Court justice. I believe that each state will have to nominate, the governor would nominate, and based on the advice and consent of their own legislature, they would determine if that person would be appointed to that position as the state chief judge, who would then be would sit on a seat in the Supreme Court. In other words, that would be the position that they're filling, just kind of like how the senators are selected, except it is done by the executive with the work of the legislature. That makes sense, right?
Yes, sir.
And there's a good chance that you actually might have a judge sitting on the Supreme Court that graduated law from the University of Wyoming instead of the Ivy Tower, and have more of a working knowledge of the law in, you know, in different ways than what these concepts that they teach from the Ivy Tower education system. We're not better off because we don't, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about diversity, right? And the benefits of diversity. Well, if there are benefits of diversity, then there are actual real benefits, like physical benefits, you know, i.e., you know, being taller in certain positions or being able to perform certain functions, like on a football team. You know, do you have the skinny small guy as the lineman? Right? Right? I mean, there are very specific things, and you have diversity because you do have a skinny small guy or a skinny tall guy. He's your wide receiver. Or in baseball, you know, there are very specific roles that you have to seek after, and you want a very specific talent. But not everybody is a pitcher on a baseball team, because you need to have people that can field and bat and so forth. You have to develop, and that's what I would say, in the natural speak, that is a diverse team, right?
Yes, sir.
It does.
Their diversity only
demographics. Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Physical attributes.
And actually, so one of the arguments I always made is when we look at America, well, we actually are a melting pot. In other words, we have a lot of different cultures here. But that doesn't mean that we are better if we ensure that we have a quota system for those demographics. You can look, because when they say you will perform better if you actually have quotas for demographics, well, that flies in the face of reason and common sense and logic. Let's look at Japan. How much mixed culture does Japan have and Germany have? Very little. Do they have superior products, or is our DEI or our diverse concept superior to their products and what we do? See my point?
Yes, sir.
And so the concept doesn't, you know, it doesn't hold water when they really lay it out there that demographics is important. No, the skills, the education, you know, maybe physical attributes. That's important. Those things that are relative to the job and to the position, to the work, that is what's important. And you do have to have a diverse team. A diverse team that actually has the distributive skills that's required to do the work. And so, I mean, this is just common sense. This is just business sense. And the fact that business schools are teaching, well, back to the court, we could actually see what I would say as a relative representative court system by having 50 judges. And because we have 50 judges, that means that the chief judge, who would be appointed by the president, would be the deciding vote, right? And if we have admit a new state to where we have 51 states with 51 judges, then the president would have to appoint a second judge to be the deciding vote. So there'd be a chief judge and an assistant or a vice chief judge, whatever you want to call it, right? So that way, you know, you always have a tiebreaker. But then the courts would be able to actually divvy up, because we don't have to all sit in the same spot. And the courts could actually divvy up the seats to make sure, this is where you could either do round robin or what have you, so that you make sure that the courts aren't necessarily seated in the regions where they live, because they may actually have favorable views one way or the other, you know, to support the agenda of those states or what have you. You want to make sure justice is blind, so there would be kind of a, you know, this rotation of where the justices would sit. But if you look at the jurisdiction of the federal courts, because we're going to get into this when we get into Article 3, when we look at what they really have jurisdiction over, then we don't need as many judges, and we don't need as many courts and court clerks and all this other crap. They shouldn't be accepting everything under the sun. Therefore, if they're only working on those things, they would still be underworked, if that makes sense, because they don't have jurisdiction over all things under the sun. So when the states, and actually this is where I believe we'll actually get to a point, because these judges representing the states will make sure that the federal courts aren't getting into the state knickers. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely.
So this is how a representative government can actually protect itself, and this is how the court system was basically wide open for corruption. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir, it does.
And
especially when you're speaking about the way you would do it differently, because like you said, all they might have a diversity of physical traits, but they all come from the same ideology, and they are up on this pedestal like they're the rulers, you know, and they have no connection to the people. As you were saying, the president's selected by the people, the representative's selected by the people, but then the judges are totally disconnected. And I think that's part of the reason we are where we are.
Yeah, good point. So I'm just saying that, you know, there are really good amendments that would actually change and make our governing better. And in this particular case regarding judges, I think another huge problem, the framers were literally wrong by creating a lifetime appointment to the judges. I believe that that right there secured them in making it very hard to get rid of them, and it empowered them to be able to get onto the court to move agendas, which the Warren Court clearly did. The Warren Court clearly drove agendas, and there have been other courts. The Taney Court clearly drove agendas. When you look at the early judges from what Hamilton provided John Adams, many of those judges that were basically seated by John Adams were pro-slavery Southern paradigms. And John Adams, being a staunch anti or abolitionist, John Adams had no idea what he was doing. This was literally something that was being done by, I'll just say, Hamilton and his evil doing. So anyway, anything else?
Like Trump's first term.
Yeah, okay. So let's dive into the next one. Go ahead. Define punishments of piracies.
Nine. Okay. The Congress shall have power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations.
Okay. So, interesting. They include the law of nations. Folks, I want you to understand this, that when the Constitution was discussed, you know, in defining natural law, these types of things, those things were established standards, common knowledge of what a natural-born person was in the laws of nations. So when you really look at the debates, you'll actually see them point out how the framers were literally citing these concepts of natural, or not natural law, the laws of nations. What we see right here is another jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction for the federal courts. Or for the federal government, period. So, in other words, they have the ability to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas. So, are those crimes, the piracies and felonies, are those crimes being committed within the United States?
No.
No, because the high seas is where? Outside our boundaries, our, you know, our coastlines, right? High seas is considered international water. So, this right here, and offenses against the laws of nations, how would you, back then and even today, how would you be offending or violating a law of nations? That's international law, right? So we'll have to dive into this tomorrow. So we will get back into this so that we can actually dive into how both of these are not crimes that are committed within the United States, and why this is so important. So with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.